This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
Happy heathens and godless infidels and all you evil little things. More about that later. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor and welcome to Free Thought Radio.
You're not an evil little thing.
No, nor are our listeners.
But you'll hear about why we use that phrase. I'm Dan Barker. I'm your friendly neighborhood atheist. And this is the 300th show of Free Thought Radio. Can you believe that?
Congratulations.
Almost, what, almost 6 years now? 5.5 years of doing
this
show?
It's been fun.
This is the weekend of January the 21st and 22nd, 2012. 12122202, if you remember that. Free Thought Radio broadcasts in Madison, Wisconsin. And we also want to say hello to all you podcast listeners and those of you listening to the broadcast in Grand Rapids, in Monterey, New York City, and Milwaukee.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. FFRF, with more than 17,500 members, is the nation's largest association of freethinkers, atheists and agnostics, and others who make known our dissent from religion.
And we also work diligently to keep religion out of government and to educate also about the harm of religion in politics. Did you see last week when all these evangelical leaders got together, they're in a quandary about whom to anoint for the nomination to the presidency? James Dobson and Tony Perkins, and who else was there? Just a lot of these.
The usual suspects.
Usual suspects. That reminds me of a joke that I told years ago, but I can update it now. There was this huge ecumenical conference, but when the plane was landing, there was a horrible snowstorm, horrible Sauktan snowstorm, and it had to make an emergency landing, and people had to get out of this little airport and find someplace to sleep and not freeze for the night. So this taxi driver was driving a rabbi and a Hindu monk and James Dobson. He's the head of the Focus on the Family. He's the former head of Focus on the Family, the big evangelical leader.
Calls himself a kingmaker.
Yeah. They stopped at, and the storm was horrible, so the taxi stopped and the guy said, "I'm going to have to go back into town. You guys go to that farmhouse." They knocked on the door of the farmhouse, and the farmer said, "Oh, sure, you three can stay here. Sure, we have, except I only have room for two of you. One of you is going to have to sleep out in the barn." So the rabbi said, "I'll sleep out in the barn. That's no problem." So he went out there. But a few minutes later, there's this knock on the door, and it's the rabbi. And the rabbi says, "I'm sorry, I can't sleep in the barn. There's a pig out there, and the pig is an unclean animal, and I'm sorry, I cannot sleep with an unclean animal." So the Hindu monk said, "I will sleep in the barn." So he went out there. But a few minutes later, there's a knock on the door. And the Hindu monk says, "I'm sorry, I cannot sleep in the barn. There's a cow out there. And the cow is a sacred animal. I cannot desecrate the place where a sacred animal lives." So James stops and says, "Well, okay, I'll go sleep out in the barn." He went out there. And a few minutes later, there's a knock on the door. It's the cow and the pig.
And it's hard to say his name, James Dobson, without wanting to add, "Focus on your own damn family."
You see that bumper sticker in Colorado Springs a lot.
On the second half of today's show, we'll be interviewing George Levine, editor of a new anthology, The Joy of Secularism, 11 Essays for How We Live Now. Levine is professor emeritus of English at Rutgers, and he's had other books such as Darwin Loves You.
Well, that's going to be a fun interview. One of the joys of secularism is when the courts do the right thing and reaffirm secularism in our government and in our public schools.
This week, we do want to celebrate two important state church victories and to say hooray for Jessica Alquist, the diminutive 16-year-old Rhode Island teenager who won her lawsuit against her public school's prayer banner On January 11th, you may remember Jessica's been on our show and was named a Thomas Jefferson Student Activist Awardee at our October convention with a $1,000 scholarship.
And we want to warmly congratulate Jessica for serving as lead plaintiff in this lawsuit, which resulted in a January 11th decision by U.S. District Judge Ronald Lagoux. How do you say that?
Lagoux.
He said, the banner must be removed immediately. The banner is titled School Prayer and addresses Our Heavenly Father, and it ends with the word Amen. The judge not only ruled in Jessica's favor, but noted that she is clearly an articulate and courageous young woman who took a brave stand, particularly in light of the hostile response she has received from her community.
And to get that kind of praise in an actual ruling by a judge is really exceptional. And in her speech to the Freedom From Religion Foundation, we're going to hear an excerpt in a couple minutes, she described how the community became arrayed against her and the other critics of this prayer banner.
Adding to the fray was the vicious reaction of, believe this or not, her own Rhode Island State Representative, Peter Palumbo. He's a Democrat. And, well, he did an interview on the John DePietro show on News Talk this last week, News Talk 630 and WPRO and 99.7 FM. And listen to what he called Jessica Ahlquist.
In studio with us, Representative Peter Palumbo. Good morning, Representative Palumbo.
Good morning, John.
So proud.
So proud.
Oh,
so
what
proud.
She's been through.
What an evil little thing. Poor thing. And it's not her fault. She's being trained to be like that.
You think she's an evil little thing?
Well, I think she's being coerced by evil people.
So, hard to believe. I mean, FFRF sent a strong letter calling Colombo's attack vicious, unwarranted, irresponsible, and we told him if anything is evil, it is your inflammatory words contributing to a situation in which an entire community, if not state, appears to be arrayed against one young, brave, and tiny teenager. Your reckless and unprofessional words as an elected official endanger Jessica's standing and her security in the community. We told him, pick on someone your own size and stop misusing your legislative office to bully a minor. And I would add that this lawsuit should never have been necessary. It is settled law that religious ritual and devotions do not belong in public schools. And what has happened to Jessica shows why they do not belong. They are divisive.
A lot of Catholics have been denouncing Jessica, but it's ironic because it was Roman Catholics in previous centuries who were a minority who took courageous stands against prayer and religious devotions in our public schools. Here in Wisconsin, there was a case called Weiss versus District Board in 1890, in which they kicked out Bible reading because it was the King James Version, and the Catholics bravely fought against religious orthodoxy in government. In that Weiss decision, the judge said, there is no such source and cause of strife, quarrel, fights, malignant opposition, persecution, and war, and all evil in the state as religion. Let it once enter our civil affairs, our government would soon be destroyed. Let it once enter our common schools, they would be destroyed. You can find out how to support Jessica and how to contact Representative Palumbo, joining our call that he apologized. If you go to our webpage, ffrf.org/news/action, and just to get that nasty taste out of our mouth of what this legislator called Jessica, let's hear just a little bit of excerpts of Jessica in her own words explaining the situation.
A friend of mine told me that there was a prayer on the wall in the auditorium. I went in to see it, and when I did, I was pretty surprised. I didn't think that my school would have something like that in it. I had been doing research on the prayer, on prayers in schools in general, and during that time, over the summer, another parent kind of beat me to it and made a complaint. There were some subcommittee meetings that happened because the school didn't want to just remove it right away. And I went to one in November with my friend who was on the subcommittee. They discussed it for a while, and at the conclusion of the meeting, they said that they wanted to hold another meeting, basically. I had spoken at that meeting, and I identified myself as an atheist. When I did, somebody gasped, and yeah, and somebody else whispered under their breath that I was a little witch. So I didn't feel very welcome there, obviously, from the very beginning. They had another meeting, and I spoke at that meeting also, and, you know, a lot of people just, I could feel how much people hated me. People were staring at me, they were glaring. From the very, very beginning of all this, it was very unfriendly. They were angry from the very start. And that was reflected at school, too. In my school, it was on the news a couple of times, and weird things started happening. I would sneeze in class, and people would scream, "God bless you," in my face. And the full committee voted on keeping the prayer, or not to keep the prayer, and they decided to keep it. And as a result, the ACLU had contacted me, and I told them that I would become the plaintiff in a lawsuit against my city. So we did. We filed a lawsuit against the city of Cranston to take the prayer down. And that caused a lot of trouble. In school the next day, I went into homeroom, and people were already talking about it. They were saying that I was mad, stupid, and things like that. So when we all rose to say the pledge, I don't say it because I don't agree with it. I think the under God shouldn't belong there. When we rose to say the pledge, though, people at the appropriate time turned and yelled under God at me. It was really hurtful, and for a long time I was really bothered by it. I went home that day and I was crying. The whole day, I think, was ruined because of that one thing that happened in homeroom. That can be scary. It can be really scary, especially because there has been some violence in my school recently. Sometimes when I get off the bus, people drive past my house screaming things out the window. One event that I remember from last year was during Diversity Week at my school. Yeah. And the Chinese-American mayor of my city came in to give a talk about minorities and how even as minorities, he succeeded and he became mayor, despite some discrimination he faced. And one of the students asked him how he felt about the school prayer. And he pointed to it and he said, "I would like to see that prayer stay exactly where it is." Just about every single person in the auditorium started cheering and clapping, and they all stood up and started, you know, cheering on the mayor for basically being a complete hypocrite. So I was sitting there, and I was trying not to cry. It was really unexpected. Not that I didn't know what his opinion on it was prior to that. He had said on TV once that my family was just looking for money. In case that comes up, we're asking for $25. Yeah. The legal advice was to do that. I didn't want any money from this. I also am not lying when I say that this is offensive. The prayer can be offensive. It's entitled School Prayer. It addresses our Heavenly Father and it ends with Amen. They've argued that it isn't a prayer. They've argued that it's historical. But one claim that I don't think they can fairly make is that I'm not offended by this. Because I am, and other people are too. Even Christians are. I have a Muslim friend who is. They're trying to keep the prayer in the school simply for the reason of pushing God onto people who don't want it pushed on them. And they've succeeded many times. When I was younger, I didn't think that this would be a problem. I didn't see this as necessarily something that needed to be fought all the time. But the more research I did, the more I learned, I found out that religion can be a big problem. And that kind of inspired me to, when I saw this prayer, start fighting it. And when I was faced with the option of suing my city, I decided to say yes. It's been really hard, but I'm going to get through this, and hopefully when I do, the prayer will be removed.
And it should be, because there was a ruling 10 days ago, it is unconstitutional and must be removed. Now, I have to add that death threats were posted on the Cranston Herald Facebook. They were removed quickly by the newspaper. She's been the target of threats mostly on Facebook and Twitter. But Jessica showed up to attend a photo op in front of FFRF's huge Keep Religion Out of Politics billboard that's still up in Warwick, Rhode Island last week. And the reporter who covered the event said she didn't seem fazed by threats or media attention. She is a young woman with spine.
I'm Dan Barker here with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be right back to talk about yet another court victory, state church separation, and we'll hear a little music by secular composers who were born this week in history.
This is Free Thought Radio with your hosts, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-directors of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a 501c3 educational charity and membership group. And we hope today you'll join us at FFRF.org.
And there's another court victory this week.
Yes. And just a tip of the hat, as Stephen Colbert would say, to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals a week ago Friday, which was victorious in its decision against sectarian school prayer. The Supreme Court denied cert in an appeal by religious right groups to overturn that case. So in other words, the Supreme Court let stand the decision of the Fourth Circuit that prevents government bodies from beginning their meetings with sectarian prayer. This is the Court of Appeals in the Fourth Circuit's third ruling, upholding non-sectarian prayer, saying don't have it at all if you're going to have sectarian prayer. And it really is a good shot in the arm because we get more complaints from adults. We usually get school complaints, the majority of our complaints on state church violations. But with adults, the majority complaint is my government body, my city council, my county board is praying to Jesus. And so it was a lovely bit of action or non-action by the Supreme Court. And we will work even harder to encourage the other circuits to follow suit.
On January the 27th, we celebrate the birthdays of two non-believing composers. Mozart was born in 1756. He was raised Catholic, but he neglected his religion. He joined the Freemasons, who condemned the Catholic Church. When he was dying, he refused to ask for a priest. His wife asked for one anyway, and the priest refused to attend. He was buried in a pauper's grave, and referring to the orthodoxy of his youth, Mozart said, "That's all over and will never come back." Also on January 27th, Jerome Kern, in 1885, a prolific Broadway American songwriter. He wrote The Way You Look Tonight, which we will hear Fred Astaire singing. He also wrote Showboat, which we will hear some tunes, a little bit of Lena Horne and Paul Robeson.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
Fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly. I gotta love one man till I die. Can't help loving that man of mine.
Old Man River, that old man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton, them that plants them is soon forgotten. But old man River,
geez, if I was going to worship something, I think it would be Paul Robeson's voice, and he was a good free thinker. And how's Kern in comparison to hymns? Give me Jerome Kern's hymns any day.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie. Stay tuned. We're going to talk about the joy of secularism in the next part of our show. George Levine, or we'll have to ask him if it's George Levine. George Levine is the editor of a new book, The Joy of Secularism, 11 Essays for How We Live Now, showing that the non-religious life is not negative, it's a very positive.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at FFRF.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And we have on the phone with us today from New Jersey, George Levine. He's the editor of a brand new book. The book is called The Joy of Secularism, 11 Essays for How We Live Now. George Levine is Professor Emeritus of English at Rutgers University.
Hello.
And he's the founder and former director of the Rutgers Center for Cultural Analysis. His many books include Darwin and the Novelist, Darwin Loves You, and his book, Realism, Ethics, and Secularism, was awarded a prize, the best book in the field of literature and science, by the British Society for Literature and Science. So welcome to Free Thought Radio, George.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
And the cover of this book is really cute.
Yes, it's The Joy of Secularism, and of course it's sort of a mock The Joy of Cooking because it's got the red and white check, so that's really cute.
Exactly.
Like
yeah.
That gingham tablecloth or curtain look.
Right.
Yeah, and it's very, very accessible, very homey, very warm look. I love what you write in the book. You say, secularism is not a falling away, a necessary loss, but it's a damned good thing. Secularism should be seen as an improvement story. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the problems with the arguments about secularism, and especially in recent culture, has been that it's always been taken as a weak substitute for religion itself. And the point of the whole book, and even of the cover, giving that sense of warmth and secular pleasures, is that secularism is a way of being that is more in touch with the truth of the way the world actually is, and can bring us then to a better condition in the world as it really is. So secularism is not a loss from religion, but as I would argue, it's a gain.
Well, I would agree.
Yeah, we often hear from believers who say, oh, you must lead these sad, empty, meaningless lives if you don't have a higher power to believe in.
Yeah, well, that's one of the keys to my argument about secularism, and not only mine, but of course most of the writers for the book, a dependence on some power beyond the world in order to get us through the world is a very dangerous and misleading kind of thing. And the book is trying to insist that the world is acceptable, we have no choice, on its own terms, and that relying on a source beyond the world leads us to undervalue the world itself, the secular world. That's what we live in, and that's what we need to come to terms with on the terms that the secular will allow.
And also what we can achieve for ourselves and not depending on some wishful thinking, right?
Exactly.
Now, I really
more than, for me and for many of the writers, it's more than just sort of depending on ourselves. Indeed, that's one of the keys of the book. But the danger of turning to a power beyond the world in order to make this world more tolerable is that the power beyond the world begins to substitute for this world, and we give more deference and more attention to what isn't than to what is. So there's a, for me and for most secularists, I think there's a real loss in relying on the world beyond the world when what really needs attention is this world right here and right now.
Well, hear, hear, amen.
Okay.
And I really like this quote, Franz de Waal,
yes.
I don't know how to say that.
That's right.
Perhaps it is just me, but I am wary of anyone whose belief system is the only thing standing between them and repulsive behavior.
That's a good line.
Yeah. Well, that's There's a curious way, and there's a long tradition of this in secular thought, and it's one of the most attractive parts of it to me, that secularism turns out, in this view, to be more moral than a religious view, because the religious view of ethics does require us to be subservient to some other power. The only reason that we behave well is that there's a higher power who demands it of us, whereas in a secularly imagined world, the only thing that makes us moral is ourselves. We make the choices, and we are not bidden to do it, and we are not afraid of eternal punishment that keeps us being nice to our neighbors. What keeps us being nice to our neighbors is that we love them. That seems to me to be a really critical part of the ethical program that a real secular view of the world would entail.
And Franz De Waal, as Annie Laurie quoted, has an excellent essay in here about the natural origin for our moral and ethical feelings and impulses and instincts. And I have a lot of his books. I love his work on the primates, and it was a real pleasure to see him in your book. I especially also loved the final essay, Rebecca Stott.
Yes,
I have her book on Darwin and the Barnacle. I have that book, but a gorgeous essay about art and literature and Darwin's motivation, where she talks about why are we looking up for meaning? Why not look down? And at the end of Darwin's life, he was looking at earthworms, of all things, and finding this beauty and this joy. Other contributors in the book are Philip Kitcher, Charles Taylor, Bruce Robbins, William Connolly, Adam Phillips, Paolo Costa from Italy, David Sloan Wilson. I have his book, Evolution for Everyone, and Robert J. Richards. It must have been fun collaborating with all of these people.
Well, I was really excited about this. I had been feeling, I know that among the champions of the secular view are writers like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, whom I, of course, greatly respect. But that kind of writing is in some ways rhetorically very dangerous in that, or it can be, in that it assumes that there is some kind of fundamental inferiority in people who have religious views. And so the attitudes implied by the books are often taken as being just fundamentally hostile to all the things that religion is taken to represent. And my view was that this is a rhetoric that is less likely to be successful. I may be wrong about this. Less likely to be successful, brilliant as these writers are, than a rhetoric that takes into account the kinds of moral and emotional needs that people have and tries to demonstrate that these things that people seem to value so much are accessible, and in the long run, even more accessible through a secular rather than a religious view. And when I started to think about this way of thinking, I wrote to these, I don't know if you recognize all of them, but they're really distinguished writers, all of whom have written interestingly on secular matters. And I wrote expecting, well, everyone would turn me down, or 90% of them would turn me down. And each one of them, when they got my invitation, expressed immediate enthusiasm. And I had absolutely no trouble gathering these extraordinary writers to produce this book. It was a thrilling thing for me. It was as though, you know, there's a whole cluster of these brilliant minds out there who are all convinced secularists believe in the fundamental necessity for and value of a secular view of the world, but want to find a rhetoric that is more likely to draw into its world an audience that somehow feels that the only way to be moral is to look beyond the world as it is. the only way to get spiritual satisfaction is to look beyond the world as it is. These are all writers who have imagined in great detail how it is possible to be both moral and spiritually satisfied without turning beyond the world. So it was a great pleasure. And all of them have something extremely interesting to say on the subject, as I think you may have noticed.
We'll talk more about that. We are talking with George Levine about the joy of secularism. Some of the chapters are called Enchantment, No Thank You, Challenges for Secularism, A Secular Wonder. I'm Annie Laurie Geller with Dan Barker, and we're listening to a little bit more Mozart in honor of his birth date this week. And we'll be back with Freethought Radio in a couple of minutes.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. This is Freethought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And we're continuing our conversation with George Levine, his new book, which he edited with 11 contributions. It's called The Joy of Secularism, 11 Essays for How We Live Now. George Levine is Professor Emeritus of English at Rutgers University. Now, George, I don't want to contradict, but I want to expand on what you said earlier. I think there's a place for both. I think if you're planting a garden, you need those who plant the seeds and tend to the flowers, but you also need the Dawkins and the Hitchens who are pulling up the weeds.
As Ingersoll would say.
I think you need both of those, and perhaps different people respond in different ways to these approaches.
Yeah.
But
no, actually, I do agree with you, and it does seem to me that Dawkins and Hitchens, alas, he recently died, and Dennett have made important inroads, and I guess how you put it, he's pulling up the weeds, and they're telling lots of truths, and I wouldn't mean that I want to get rid of them, but I do think that another kind of rhetoric is really crucial.
Yeah, now that we're tending to the flowers of the beautiful natural universe that we live in, and that seems to be a theme in the book, Darwin's earthworms and the flowers under our feet. And one of the themes through these essays I notice is this rejection of the word transcendent, and an argument, I think, within the book about whether we should even use the word enchantment.
Right. There's a splendid essay, second or third essay in the book, by Bruce Robbins, who was offended politically and intellectually by the word enchantment. And, the story is taking up from something that the famous sociologist Max Weber said, that with the advent of science and science's claim to be able to explain everything, the enchantment went out of the world. I myself actually pick up the word enchantment for various reasons, but Robbins' argument, and it's really a very powerful one, is that what we're talking about as enchantment, the kind of spiritual satisfactions that one got in a pre-secular world, simply describes a condition in which the secular life, the real life of most people, was pretty brutal and miserable, so that invoking enchantment or insisting on the re-enchantment of the world, as I sometimes myself do, is a way to disguise from ourselves the deep kinds of political urgencies to which we ought to be committed in making life here better. On the war on poverty and on injustice and all that sort of stuff. Enchantment, from Robbins' point of view, disguises that. But there is a long tradition of the idea of disenchantment. And one of the things that propelled me in writing this book and other books before it is my insistence that whatever it is that people think was lost with the loss of enchantment is actually still there and more thrilling.
Yeah.
Dawkins himself has several wonderful books. I can't remember exactly what it's called, something about the rainbow.
Unweaving the rainbow, yeah.
Unweaving the rainbow.
And in there he calls for the same thing that David Sloan Wilson calls for in your book, integrating more art in the sciences.
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, you know, since I am an English professor, I am deeply committed to including more art. But one of the things that also drives me is my passion for birding, you know, which puts me over and over again in positions out there in the natural world, which make it astonishing for me that anybody would think this is an awful, dreary, miserable place. The experience of what I have taken up to call enchantment myself is available to anyone who just has time and the eyes to look at the natural
because
world.
We're all human beings, religious or not, and we're all feeling these same things, the feelings that I get when I'm playing jazz piano in a combo, this illusion of transcendence, which we know is an illusion, but it's something to live for, those moments that Rebecca Stott says, instead of thinking of it as being raising us up higher, what did she call it? We are falling upwards, or we're actually going...
Yeah, falling upwards. She cites this extraordinary poem by Amy Clampett. That's the last lines in the book. And she reprint that whole poem because it's such a beautiful poem, but it ends with the vision of this extraordinary flower growing up out of the tundra. And when you look down into it, it's like looking into the sun, so that as you look down, you start to fall upward.
Yeah.
And I really wanted that to be the closing line of the book, because that's exactly how I imagine this movement into secularism. It's not a falling, it's a falling upward into something better and more beautiful.
Now, we've been talking about your new anthology that you edited, The Joy of Secularism, 11 Essays for How We Live Now. And this was Princeton Press, is that right?
Yes, Princeton Press, right.
And a beautiful book that looks kind of like The Joy of Cooking.
Right.
But we have a little bit of time left, just a little bit, and I wanted to have you say something about your 2006 book, Darwin Loves You. What is that about?
Right. Well, I've been obsessed with Darwin for about 25 years and have written quite a lot about him. But that book was the culmination of my interest because I wanted to make the argument that while most of the time when people use the word Darwinian, they're thinking of nature red and tooth and claw and a world violent and hostile and competitive. And I wanted to demonstrate that if you read Darwin closely and carefully, what you find is something much more complicated and much richer than that. And I have a chapter in the book called A Kinder, Gentler Darwin, in which I try to show that Darwin's own vision of the world was a vision of someone who absolutely loved it, who found the natural world extraordinary and beautiful and complex in ways that fill it full of meaning. And so I tried to, in Darwin Loves You, I tried to describe a Darwin who is not about nature red in tooth and claw. Of course, he is partly about that, but about a nature that is very much worth loving and that can provide for us a life of spiritual satisfaction as well as material one.
Like what Pinker said in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, which just came out, that we have inherited instincts toward altruism and compassion and cooperation and social unity, which over the long run are actually more common to our species than those rare moments of violence.
Yeah, well, I've read more about that book than I have so far read it, but yes, that's part of Duhal's argument in The Joy of Secularism as well. Of course, he tries to demonstrate that there are altruistic instincts even in bonobos and chimpanzees. And we have indeed inherited that in our DNA, as well as some of the other stuff that we don't like that much. So yes, it's very important to be able to look at the secular world and recognize its intrinsic capacity for morality and goodness and beauty and not to be too sentimental, love.
Well, thank you. We're talking with George Levine about his brand new book, which he edited, The Joy of Secularism, 11 Essays for How We Live Now.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
We also want to thank again David McCann, who's doing a great job of taking over for Brian Tarani for engineering and producing the show. The show is produced in Madison, Wisconsin. Hear all the details and read about it all at our website, ffrf.org/radio.
You can join the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. You can leave your name and address if you want info sent by calling 1-800-335-4021. And we do urge you to join us. We'd like to be 20,000 or 50,000 or 150,000 strong instead of 17,500. Let's flex our muscles. And we invite you to tune in next week for more Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday